Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Peyto's second quarter 2013 conference call. With me in the room today, we've got Scott Robinson, our Chief Operating Officer. We've got Kathy Turgeon, our CFO. Dave Thomas, our VP Exploration. JP Lachance, our VP Exploitation. Our VP of Land, Tim Louie, is away on vacation, so he's not with us today. And of course, we've got our Investor Awareness Rep, Jim Grant, here with us as well. Before we get started, though, I wanted to take an opportunity to send out a big thank you to our Peyto team here. We've had another amazing quarter of results, and I think it's directly a result of their hard work and dedication to creating shareholder value that we've achieved the success we have here this quarter. So I think on behalf of all shareholders, I just want to send out a big thank you. And Jim, I see you've got a bunch of questions you've assembled there from various sources, so maybe we should kick it off with you.
Okay, for those of you who are new to our conference calls, we hold the first
half as a question and answer session where I ask some of the senior management questions about Peyto and its latest financials before we turn the call over to questions from investors and representatives of investment businesses. So, Darren, when you look at the funds from operations for our second quarter 2013 results, they show the compounding of production and price increases over the same period last year. Where is this taking us?
Jim, you know, it's finally nice, I think, to have both prices and production going in the right direction. We've been building production, obviously, for a number of years now. I think this is our 15th consecutive quarter of production per share growth. But we've been fighting gas prices, obviously, all along. We've had gas prices going the opposite direction. So in some ways, it's a bit frustrating that we don't get the full effect of production growth on our cash flow. This quarter, of course, we had prices that were up significantly as well. So a huge increase in our cash flow. And, you know, I think really that gives us a bit of an insight as to the real torque in the production growth that we have been putting up, you know, at gas prices with a three handle on it, you know, and at current production levels, we're generating close to $500 million in cash flow, which obviously is a lot of money that we can use to fund some pretty spectacular growth, you know, some of the best growth we've ever had. So, you know, I think gas prices are just volatile, there's no question, but it's nice to finally see them up as well as the production up.
Okay. Turning to Scott Robinson, our COO and VP of Operations. Scott, can you give us an overview of the operational activities for the second quarter and comment on the differences between this spring and last spring?
Yeah, sure, Jim. I think as we all know, the second quarter typically is divided up into two abbreviated periods, one before breakup, which occurs in early April, and then after breakup towards the end of May into June. So those are the two periods of activity that we normally see each and every year. This past second quarter, we started out as usual with a very busy April period involving the completion and tie-in of a number of wells, about 10, and the completion of a couple pipeline projects. And all of that work in April resulted in the culmination of a pretty good production growth up to the 60,000 barrel mark by the end of April. It was the post-breakup period that was a challenge this year. It was atypical compared to past years. The wet weather conditions really hampered our June operations and really delayed our progress and prevented us from adding any new production that we normally would have added in a typical year. So this delay, you know, just set us back in time. We're now catching up on that backlog, and our production is returning to the levels that we had expected.
Okay. And turning to JP Lachance, our VP of Exploitation. JP, in the Q2 news release, we have commented on positive results in the Blue Sky Formation. A few conference calls ago, we spoke about our early activities related to the development of this zone. What can you tell us about the progress we've made over the last few quarters, and what might lay ahead for our Blue Sky prospects?
Thanks, Jim. Prior to 2013, we drilled 5 horizontal Blue Sky wells, testing a couple of different areas on our land base. We followed up with 6 additional horizontal wells in 2013 so far, with 5 of those now on stream and 1 scheduled to be completed next week. Now, the results are very consistent with wells producing at initial restricted rates between 5 and 6 million cubic feet a day of gas, plus separator liquids of 11 barrels per million, most of which is condensate. These wells have exceeded our expectations and continue to beat the type curve we use for planning purposes. The half-cycle rate of return of our type curve yields a rate of 35% at today's strip pricing, while full-cycle rate of return comes in at about 24%, when we add in a provision for our typical non-well-rated capital. And not only is our production performance exceeding expectations, but we've got our costs down too. Our last four wells have been drilled and completed for an average cost of about $4.2 million versus $4.5 to $5 million in the past. We're excited about our results in the Blue Sky to date, so we plan to drill another five more by year-end, which still leaves us approximately 70 wells in inventory across our greater Sundance land base.
Okay.
Scott, our operating costs for this quarter are up slightly over recent levels. Can you provide some meaning to this increase and comment on whether it's something we should expect to continue?
Yeah, the main message I think that we should make about our cost level is that we actually are right on track. There are no concerns with this quarter over any kind of quarter over quarter cost creep. If we look back to 2010 when we turned our practices to horizontal wells and review our costs over that period since 2010, the annual costs have ranged from 32 to 35 cents per MCF equivalent. And within that, the quarterly variation has been 29 to 39 cents. So our 35 cents this past quarter is right in that range, nothing unusual. There were a couple of cost categories this past quarter that did contribute to this increase, and they're worth mentioning, but those are not likely to be recurring. The first one, we experienced about a 3 cent an MCF increase because of a doubling of the cost of purchased electricity during this period. There were a few power plant outages in Alberta that disrupted supply, and it temporarily drove up the cost of electricity. This cost, however, has returned back to normal levels as experienced or seen in July here, so we don't expect that to continue. We've also had some additional maintenance items that contributed to our costs during this past quarter that occurred at our Old Mound facility, but we believe the problems associated with those are rectified. So again, in summary, we're small increases in costs this past quarter, but we don't expect to be a problem in the future, and we're confident that our costs will remain within our historical range and leading the industry at that.
Okay. Now, turning to our VP of Exploration, Dave Thomas. Dave, we speak about acquiring a substantial land position in a new area to us, Brazeau River. What can you say about this area and the work we have done to evaluate its potential and incorporate it into our future plan?
Jim, back in December of 2010, we purchased about 10 sections of land in Brazeau where we'd identified a Wilrich sand target and a vertical well that we wanted to test horizontally. We recognized that the Wilrich was quite deep with drill depths ranging from 3,000 to 3,300 meters here, but the porosity was good at 9 to 12%. And the reservoir pressure was high at 35,000 kPa. And we also saw that the area held multi-zone potentials similar to Sundance. So we drilled our first Wilrich horizontal well in 2011, and we felt the test results were very encouraging. Since then, we've purchased approximately 275 square kilometers of 3D seismic data and drilled an additional two Wilrich horizontal wells, which gradually building up our land position to 98 sections, which is just shy of three townships. For the remainder of 2013, we plan to drill an additional three Brazeau wells. One of these wells will test a new zone, the upper Falher, and one will be a Wilrich test in an area we're calling South Brazeau, down in Township 42, Range 13, West 5. This is a full two-township step out to the south from our existing Brazeau Wilrich wells, and we hope to plant a successful goalpost down there to establish a large drilling trend where we own most of the Mannville petroleum and natural gas rights. Looking forward into 2014 and pending continued success, we intend to continue delineating our Wilrich play plus test the middle Falher and the Notikewin zones. If we're successful, we'll have established four zones to chase. So we're excited about the room to grow at Brazeau, but I'd like to point out that these are still relatively early days, and we want to proceed at a pace where we can make sure the results are meeting our expectations.
Okay. JP, what infrastructure plans do we have to support the upcoming development in the Brazeau area?
Yes, Jim, we're obviously excited about the potential for this area, and we're anxious to get some production from these three existing wells. As it's early in the development and consistent with our measured approach to capital spending, we will link these wells together to a small gas facility with just enough compression and separation equipment to handle about 20 million cubic feet a day. Site construction has begun and startup is planned for early November. And Dave mentioned we have three more wells planned for later in 2013, so I hope we've under-designed our facility, and I expect we'll be talking about an expansion in early 2014.
That would be great. Kathy, turning to Kathy Turgeon, our CFO and VP of Finance, based on a question I had yesterday after our results came out, our statement of cash flows shows a total of $161 million under additions to property, plant, and equipment in the investing activities section, but our capital spending balance sheet entries for property, plant, and equipment don't reflect this much funds. It was $74 million. Where is this discrepancy?
Well, Jim, the purpose of the statement of cash flows is to provide additional information on the sources and uses of cash and cash equivalents, so essentially to reconcile opening cash to closing cash. This basically restates the financial results to a cash basis of accounting, so PP&E additions per this statement reflect the actual cash payments made during the period on account of capital expenditures, regardless of the period that that expenditure relates to. Peyto typically pays around 60 days, so this amount would consist primarily of settlement of invoices related to February, March, and April capital. To reconcile changes to PP&E per the balance sheet to the capital expenditures per the MD&A, users must go to the notes 3 and 5 of the financial statements. So per note 3, additions are $236.5 million. You adjust for the PP&E portion of the change in the decommissioning liability in note 5, which is the new provisions and the change in estimate, which brings to $242.9 million per the MD&A. If you adjust that for the Q1 capital per the MD&A, you get to $73.8 million for the Q2 capex. So capital expenditures are disclosed on an accrual accounting basis. The statement of cash flows is a cash basis.
Okay, thank you. Darren, we're drilling away with 10 rigs now that breakup is behind us. We often speak to sustainability in other areas of our business plans. Is this level of development sustainable? Do we have locations, access to rigs and materials, and most importantly, the human assets to handle this load and sustain it into the next year?
Yeah, Jim, that's supposed to be the test here for us, for sure. We knew coming out of breakup that we wanted to try and test how fast we could go, and 10 rigs arguably would be the fastest that we've ever gone before, especially 10 horizontal rigs. So, we wanted to see if we could handle that in all aspects, as you point out, including the human one. At that pace, 10 drilling rigs anyway, you're investing about $600 to $700 million a year, I think, but a $60 to $70 million a month sort of burn rate for a good 10 or 10 and a half months of operating activity. Of course, depends on the rating, but, and that, obviously includes land, facilities, all capital that we'd be investing. And that assumes that you're running all 10 rigs on 100% locations, for instance. We would have expected, actually, that we would have had some partner participation. We don't always have 100% in all the wells we're drilling, so sometimes we have partners in there. And we had thought that we would be running about 8.5 net rigs, actually, when we came out of the gates. But we've recently seen a lot of our partners going penalty, so I think the $2 gas price, even short-term, that we've seen has put a lot of pressure on our partners' economics. They obviously don't have the same kind of cost structure advantage that we have. So really, right now we're running probably closer to 10 net rigs, so that it makes the rig count actually quite potent. But, generally I think we felt that we had the locations, for sure, and we had good access to capital, we've got lots of bank lines, and we've got good cash flow, and it was really more a test of, as you put it, the human assets that we've got, the people here at Peyto. Could we do it at that pace and feel very comfortable at that pace? So far the Peyto team seems to be up to the challenge, and we're cruising along with those 10 rigs. But ultimately there's a bit of the test of time here that we're going to have to see, can we maintain at that level? And, one of the things that I've always stressed to our investors and even to the team here is that we have to still learn from every well we drill. We always want to use the most recent test results, the most recent well results, to help guide us. And we do that because I think that is the way in which we can deliver the maximum possible return on every opportunity. And if we're going too fast, then we can't learn from every next well prior to the next one we have to drill. And And that's not good. We want to be able to close that feedback loop, if you will, so that we're always learning from every piece of information that we're gaining with every well that we're drilling. Because, you know, I think one of the more fundamental things about growing is that we don't want to just be bigger. We don't want to go faster just to be a bigger organization. If we're losing profitability because we're going faster, then that's not what we're out for here. If we're going to grow, it's got to be because we're growing profitably and maintaining the same level of profitability. And so that's, I think, very important. We've all seen, you know, examples of companies, especially in the States, where these companies are growing so fast, but they're not generating any profit. So, you know, what's the use of that to the shareholder? I don't see what the point is. So, you know, to get back to your question, you know, can we sustain this level? I think we can, but, you know, it's early days at this 10-rig level, and I think we need to spend some more time at this level before we really know.
Okay. Scott, can you give us a quick rundown of other facility projects we have underway that will support all of this development activity?
JP had discussed Brazeau, where we have a facility project. We've also have two other significant projects that we've reported on in the past. Both are currently at the advanced stage of equipment fabrication. Major pieces of equipment are already completed and sitting in the various fabricators' yards ready to move. Both of these projects are also in the early stage of site preparation. So as we advance the sites, we'll start moving the equipment. The two projects are Swanson plant that's presently nearly full at 30 million cubic feet a day. We expect to complete its expansion in early October, whereby we'll add an additional 30 million capacity, but with a limited compression addition of 16 million cubic feet a day. And then the second of those two projects is our Old Man North plant, which will include a 40 million cubic feet a day initial process capacity. And we're coupling that with about 30 million cubic feet a day of compression. So those two projects, again, are on schedule for October. And thus far, everything is adding up that wouldn't cause us any concern with slippage on the time of that. These facilities will be very instrumental to our continued growth from our rest of the year drilling program as we've planned it.
Okay. JP, can you speak to where production is at right now and what our current activities in the field are?
Yeah, as was mentioned in the press release and by Scott here, we got rain delayed coming out of breakup such that we declined to a low of 53,500 BOEs a day in July. Now, embedded in that is about 1,400 BOEs a day of downtime from facility-related issues. So, in effect, we declined to 55,000 BOEs. But with 10 rigs running full out in July and four completion crews right behind them, we've made that climb back to the 60,000 BOE a day mark. We still have the existing Brazeau wells to get on stream, which total about 2,500 BOEs a day. And as well as 10 rigs in various stages of, 10 wells in various stages of being completed. Nine of which have scheduled frac dates by September 1. So we're busy again, and we're on the move upwards towards 67,000 BOEs a day and beyond by year end.
Okay. Darren, based on a question I got yesterday, going forward, how are the proportions of our capital spending that go toward drilling infrastructure and land rights going to evolve?
Jim, I think it's reasonable to expect that we're going to continue to have to invest in land seismic and facilities if we're going to continue to grow, because, you know, we're right-sizing our facilities for the production that we're bringing on. But we always want to try and keep our facilities full. That's how you spread the operating costs out on the maximum number of BOEs and keep them low. And so as we grow, we're going to have to continue to expand our facilities and our infrastructure. Of course, we have to do it a little bit in advance of the growth, because you can't build a compressor overnight, and we can't develop new locations overnight. We've got to put some time into buying lands and shooting seismic and delineating land. So, you know, I think when we look back over the last 15 years of Peyto, for instance, because we've been almost exclusively organic, we can get a real sense of what percentages we spend in typical buckets as we've grown from sort of zero to 60,000 barrels a day. Facilities, for instance, are sort of 15 to 18% of our total capital that we've invested over all that time. And, you know, just like 2013, that'll probably be about 15 to some percent of our total capital burn. Well-related capital, so drilling, completions, tie-ins, pipelines, that kind of stuff, always ends up being sort of 80 to 85% of the capital. And then land and seismic are actually a very small component, maybe 5% overall. But, you know, I think it's entirely reasonable to budget that if next year is going to be similar capital level or greater, then we're going to have 80% of that money dedicated to well-related. We're going to have 15% dedicated to facilities, and we're probably going to have about 5% dedicated to land and seismic.
Okay. So, Darren, looking forward to our activity in the fall and the winter, what would you highlight as the most important milestones for investors to watch for in our progress? And what excites you the most looking forward?
Well, Jim, you know, as JP and Scott were talking about, these next three facilities, get those up and running. That should be pretty exciting with the wells that we've got that are going to be filling those. We're going to be close to 70,000 BOEs a day, I think, by hopefully year end or very near into the new year. So that's exciting. We get to order some new pens that hopefully have some 70,000 BOEs a day on them. You know, I'm excited to get the Braswells on. As JP mentioned, you know, we've got those three wells. We're encouraged by the test rates. We're very interested in the well performance. We want to see those on. We want to see how those are going to produce and see really, you know, what kind of Wilrich wells those are. We've got, I don't know, almost probably 100 producing Wilrich wells today. So, and a whole gambit of results. You know, we've got some in higher pressure areas like our Obed, some over in Nose Hill. You know, what is some down in Ansel? What kind of Wilrich wells are these ones that we've got at Brazo? Are they going to, what sort of area are they going to be likened to? And then what are the economics ultimately, you know, what kind of post-mortem rate of returns are we going to calculate on those? So I'm excited to see what the Braswells can do. You know, we're trying some new things. We recently looked at some longer reach horizontals, so it'd be interesting to see the results of a few of those, you know, get some statistical representation there. If we drill more than just one section, we drill over two sections, see what those long reach horizontals are going to do. We've recently tried some higher density in our frac spacing, so we're excited to see how those wells pan out. We've got a data set now of horizontal wells that's large enough that we can start to tweak on the designs a little bit, and we can compare them to, you know, our existing results, and we'll know whether we're getting better or not. And so some of that little tweaking may have some very interesting results that we we'll be able to use going forward. You know, ultimately, I'm curious to see where gas prices go. You know, this recent blowout of the AECO differential, I think, is very short term. But we had some nice strength coming into the year with gas prices, you know, AECO in the low threes. You know, NYMEX Henry Hub was in the fours. Didn't seem like there was, you know, a big supply response as a result of the price improvement year over year. So, you know, if we can get back to those levels, you know, we start to generate some incredible cash flow at, you know, with gas with just a three handle on it. So hopefully we can get back to that for this winter. That's where the current strip shows us going. So, you know, I think there's a lot of neat things coming down the pike here in the next 4 or 5 months till we get to the end of the year. It's going to be an exciting third quarter for sure. This will probably be our busiest period of the year. So it's going to be a doozy. We're going to be really excited to report some results in November with all this activity.
Okay. Well, that's it for my questions. Ruth, I'd like to turn this over to questions from investors and the representatives of investment businesses.
Our first question is from Robert Bilinski from Morningstar. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, everybody, and thanks for taking my call. And, Jim, great job on the questions today. You covered most of the things I wanted to ask. Real quick, what are you targeting for well costs on your Brazo River wells? And then second, the release mentioned adding a significant number of new drilling locations from new lands and seismic. I was just wondering if you could quantify that.
You want to talk
well costs? So well costs for Brazo, we're targeting about $5 million all-in drill complete. That's what we're targeting. We're not there yet, but we're working towards that for sure. As we drill more wells like we do in Sundance, we continue to bring down costs. And we'll learn as we go forward.
Our third well in that program was pretty much in line with the cost that we have seen up in Sundance. So we've got some encouragement on that most recent well.
The Braz area, though, doesn't have a lot of well control, and there's not a lot of sort of existing location infrastructure there. There's, you know, not a lot of well sites, so. Unlike Sundance, where we can extend existing vertical sites sometimes and save quite a bit of money on construction, Braz will require a bit of new construction to start with. But we also get, in some ways, to design it right from the start without having to consider a lot of vertical wells that could be in the way of where we'd be laying in horizontal wells. So, whereas in Sundance, we're threading horizontal wells, in some cases, through vertical wells, we don't have that same issue here in Brazeau, and we can get right to, hopefully, pad drilling efficiencies early in the development. So what was the second part of the question there, Robert?
I just wondering the significant number of new drilling locations you guys added from lands and seismic. Could you put a number towards that, or maybe a percentage increase?
Down in Brazeau, there you can map 200-plus locations amongst the various formations. I don't have that breakout here.
And that wasn't the only land that we bought in the quarter either, Robert. You know, we did pick up lands in and amongst some of our other core areas, so... You know, every time we're buying new land, it's because we've already identified locations on it, and so we get to recognize those locations once we've secured the land to put that into inventory. So long as that inventory obviously is in the near term, on the reserve books, we're only recognizing the first few years of drilling inventory.
Got it. Thanks.
You bet.
Our next question is from Kevin Kaiser from HI Risk Management. Please go ahead.
Guys, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. So, nice surprise on the guidance, on the production guidance there, especially in light of the tough weather in the second quarter. Can you sort of quantify or speak to what drove that? Is it activity level, capital, well results? You mentioned some of the partners going penalty. I guess that would have something to do with it. But just speak to, I guess, what's driving the your confidence behind 70,000 BOEs per day at or around year end?
You know, in some cases, Kevin, it's just sort of timing, right? I mean, we're bringing on a lot of new production in the fourth quarter. So, I mean, had we brought that production on in the third quarter, obviously by the end of the year it would have declined a little bit. Whereas we bring it all on in the fourth quarter, then it's all brand new at sort of flush rates. So we will have a big sort of whoosh of production coming on. along with new facilities starting up, so there's a lot of stuff going on. But you're right, that, I mean, partners are going penalty, so we're getting the full potency of wells that we're drilling. And, you know, we're excited about testing this new level of activity, too. 10 rigs is very busy, but, you know, the whole point of trying it out this summer was to see whether we could maintain it going into 2014, to see whether we could consider an even bigger capital program in 2014 and sort of keep this level of activity going right through. And, you know, to be honest, though, drilling in the summertime is cheaper than drilling in the wintertime, or at least it's supposed to be if you're not dragging things around in the mud. You know, you don't have to rent boilers for heat and that kind of thing on the drilling rig. So, and we had heard there was going to be maybe a pickup in activity this winter. Now, you know, maybe the most recent pullback in AECO prices is going to pour a little bit of cold water on that, but the way gas prices were headed, we had heard some rumblings from the industry that maybe it was going to start getting busier. So we wanted to get out in front of that, obviously, and drill a lot of wells this summer. But if we don't see that pickup in activity, then maybe we can we don't have to time our activity as much to counter the industry activity.
Okay, and then on prices here, can you just give a little bit more color as to what's going on with the AECO basis? And then also, can you hit on the weak propane and butane prices and sort of your outlook for those two commodities?
Well, I can chime in first here. Scott can add. He's got some additional color. I think on a large scale, we're competing, obviously, in a more competitive market for those commodities today. Our AECO gas has to compete with, if we're shipping it all the way to the eastern side of the continent, then we've got to compete with the Marcellus, which has obviously come on strong and starting to supply more and more of the eastern demands. Added to that, we've got this TCPL tariff issue where, they were arguably trying to get people to recontract the long-haul capacity, and so they were, taking advantage of jacking up IT rates on the other side, and so that was discouraging Eastern buyers from AECO gas. And arguably they were even drawing down storage rather than pay those high rates, which they thought were short-term. And they've got Eastern supplies now in the Marcellus that they can turn to that maybe don't hold them as hostage to the AECO Western Canadian gas. So that's what's, I think, the primary cause of the differential blowout. Nobody, I don't think, is forecasting that's going to persist for too long. Winter prices are still looking at AECO getting back to the $3 mark and differentials shrinking back to sort of, I think, 50 to 70 cents, more in line with typical. Liquids prices, though, you know, propane and butane have obviously come under pressure. Butane, I think, is maybe Alberta butane is starting to reflect more North American butane prices, which were under pressure, but ours were, in some ways, I think our butane prices were held up a little bit because they were using some of it as diluent. Some of the diluent demands in Alberta, which are used for heavy oil blending, are being supplied now. There's been some new longer-term contracts that have been signed recently by some of the bigger heavy oil producers I saw that maybe take some of the pressure off diluent in Alberta, and so maybe that actually causes butane to soften a little bit locally. But I think both propane and butane, we're still in North America dealing with a bit of a surplus of supply. Maybe a bit of a hangover even of excess storage. I think those will burn off. We were seeing, I think, on our hedging going forward on propane, better prices going out.
Yeah, just to reflect on the past year here, we saw propane dip from, you know, a few years ago it was up in that $40 range and it dipped down into the teens. But it has since recovered up to the $25 to $30 a barrel mark now. So we've grabbed a few more hedges and we're optimistic that price level reflects, an establishment of a better equilibrium out there in the market. It's interesting to note the recovery of propane and butane over leaving it in the gas phase is still a very, very commercial activity, especially based on the lower current gas prices. We're looking at 2 to 4-fold value increases by recovering it. And our deep cut at Old Man is performing very well. We're getting over probably 12 to 1,400 barrels of incremental propane, butane, and a little bit of condensate. So that's working out nicely for us.
Okay, and then the last one for me is just any more color on the new Brazeau-Wilrich wells. I guess help sort of compare them to Sundance-Wilrich. It sounds like it's sort of deeper and higher pressure down there. So I guess a bit higher well costs, maybe some higher rates?
Not necessarily. I mean, in Sundance even, we've seen across the Sundance complex and, you know, in the sort of southwestern part of it, quite a bit higher pressure than we've seen in the northeastern part of it. So this is probably a lot more like the higher pressured parts of Sundance, but I don't know that the wells are that dissimilar from our Sundance area or even the Ansel ones that we've drilled. You know, and that's part of the reason that we're confident, I guess, down there is that we've got what we think to be very like Wilrich in other areas that we've already tested that's on production, that we know how it looks and how it responds and how it produces over time. So, but at the same time, you know, you feel that much more comfortable when you've got the production history behind you, when you've got the confidence of the actual data to look at. And so that's, you know, it's always something that when you're entering into a new area, you want to get the first few wells on, you want to see what they're going to do. You know, you can typically improve a little bit on the costs as you start to get in there, you know, in more development mode, but you really want to see the performance of the wells in the early days just to, you know, reaffirm that you're getting what you expected to get.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Fei Li from Odlum Brown. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Hafani here. Darren, I just had a question regarding the AECO differential, and I'm just wondering, given what you've seen, has it changed your thinking at all? Maybe at some point in the future you might want to look at hedging the difference between the AECO and NYMEX differential, basic differential?
You know, Fei, we've talked about the trying to lock the differential in. It's not an easy thing to hedge. Not only are you dealing with transportation components, but you're also dealing with currency and exchange rates. You know, in the past, we typically haven't gone there. We've tried to just do our financial hedges in Canadian dollars at AECO so that...
Embedded then.
It's in there. We've been a very active hedger, as you know. We constantly are laying in AECO hedges, trying to smooth out a lot of that volatility. I think this is very short term. This is not, obviously it's something that surprised a lot of people. Nobody was really expecting it, but at the same time, I don't think it's something that's going to persist that we need to constantly worry about. As we've said long ago, our best defense on volatile commodity prices is our cost structure advantage. I'd rather focus on our keeping our costs down and industry leading rather than trying to predict where the commodities are going to go.
Fair enough. And just a quick question for Kathy. In terms of this difference between your capital expenditure this quarter and the additions to PP&E and your cash flow statement, I'm just wondering if you've considered maybe breaking up the cash flow statement a bit more and just perhaps showing capital expenditures as they are on an accrual basis, but adding a line perhaps, say, called changes in non-cash working capital to show that difference in the timing.
And, in fact, we used to do that, but we kept getting reported for our disclosure deficiencies to the audit committee, saying that in the auditor's opinion it's not in accordance with IFRS, that you're not supposed to break out the change in non-cash working capital. It's something that we could perhaps consider doing maybe in the MD&A. But as I said, if you're looking at what are our capital additions, our capital expenditures, the notes to the financial statements is really the place to look, and also in the MD&A, not on the cash flow statement, which is a source and use of cash.
Yeah, I'm just trying to say there's an easy way to avoid that question in the future.
Always more tables, I guess.
All
right. We all love IFRS, yes.
There certainly was changes that are difficult for people to get used to.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye.
Thank you. Our next question is from Travis Wood from TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. Sorry, I joined late, so if this question was already asked, I apologize. But what I'm looking for is some color around the second half and of the 10 rigs and the planned 14 drills per month. What is the spot to on production time, and has that improved over the last 12 months drilling efficiencies? And of the wells drilled through the second half of the year, how many are you guys planning on tying in?
Well, ultimately, I think we're planning on tying in all the wells that we spud because we're expecting them all to be successful.
Not all by the end of the year.
Not all by the end of the year, though, of course. Yeah. Travis, obviously it's an ongoing thing, right? Typically, our spud to on stream times, I think now, are, as Scott's whispering to me, about 60 days. Is that right?
Or less.
60
yeah.
days or less. So, our typical well is taking sort of spud to rig release, I think 20 to 25 days. It's usually taken us probably about 7 to 10 days to get in, frack it, run tubing, get some testing done. And then we've got to get tie-ins done. And depending on where the well is, obviously, we can either have the tie-in almost done in advance if we're drilling off an existing well site, or maybe it takes a couple, 3 weeks to get some pipe in the ground if we're running to a new location. So, I think industry-wide, we've got to be the fastest guy from spud to on stream. When I've looked in the past in the Deep Basin at times from spud to on stream times, we were beating the industry by quite a large margin. In fact, probably twice as fast as our competitors tend to be, which is important. We want to get the results on quickly. We want to get cash flow coming back to us quickly from those capital expenditures. And so, yeah, it's a bit of a moving target trying to count the number of wells that we're going to have on stream by the end of the year. But, and the end of the year is really just a snapshot in time. It's not like we're coming to an all stop. There's no finish line that December 31st. This activity level, we're going to push right through and keep going. So, it is really an ongoing thing.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks, Trev.
Thank you. Our next question is from Keith McRae. He's a private investor. Please go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. I remember Brazeau from the 70s when Hudson Valley and Gas were developing the field initially is having a lot of sour gas there, and I'm wondering if there's any risk associated with the zones that you're looking at. That was my first question. The second one is, in the terms of the penalties with your well partners, where you indicated that 10 gross wells planned for 8.5 net are becoming 10 net wells, can they redeem their position with a buyout at a penalty?
Those are great questions. Maybe I just chime in initially, and Dave can add if there's some color there. But the zones that we're chasing in Brazeau are not sour. We're fully expecting sweet natural gas, and that's what we've seen in any of the test wells around there and in our results so far. You're right, though, that I mean, just like a lot of the Deep Basin, for that matter, some of the deeper targets have been sour, and a lot of the old plants that were built off of a lot of that deeper exploration work were sour gas plants. And, you know, for that very reason, we like to build our own facilities because we don't want to send our gas to some of those big, old, inefficient sour facilities that are very expensive. Instead, we build nice, new, sweet facilities that are cheap to operate, and they're, you know, designed exactly for our production stream. So we don't expect that we're chasing sour gas, and we, in fact, try to avoid it because we know how expensive it is and some of the challenges that sour gas presents. So we tend to specifically steer away from sour formations and only chase those formations with sweet gas in them. As for partners going penalty, typical land agreements are designed such that if a partner elects not to participate in a well, he's put in a penalty position where you've got to recover somewhere between probably 300% and 500% of the well costs before they get an option to convert back into a working interest position. So that's a pretty good well. You know, if we're on average investing about $5 million a well, then you know you've got a well that has to make $15 to $25 million before the partner is really given the option to be back in the well. And at these commodity prices anyway, that would be one of our best wells by far. So there's probably not a lot of conversions back. And if they happen, they're going to be pretty far out into the future.
Okay, good answers. Thank you,
Terry. Yeah, you betcha. Great. Well, I know this is a busy week of reporting for sure, so appreciate everybody taking the time to listen in to our conference call today. And, you know, we had a great quarter, and we're expecting even bigger things here into Q3. We're going to be very busy, nose to the grindstone, and hopefully the weather will cooperate a little more this quarter than last quarter. But, you know, all in, I think we've got some exciting things coming down the pipe, so stay tuned, and we'll be back to you in November with third quarter results.
Okay.